From the Firebird Radio Studio, it's the Authors on Fire podcast with nationally syndicated radio host and producer, Pat Rulo.
Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network, home of the Firebird Book Awards, the Positive Change Podcast Awards Hall of Fame, our newest book song where we create a unique, one-of-a-kind song just for your book, and this podcast, Authors on Fire. I am Pat Rulo. Today's guest is Paige Gordon, and in her book, is titled Searching for Full, her story becomes a catalyst for advocacy, for research funding, for new treatment models, and for permission to talk about the things we've been taught to hide. It is a personal narrative designed to shift public understanding and scientific priorities at the same time. It tells the story of an unexpected recovery that challenged everything Paige thought she knew about her eating disorder. She serves on the board of the directors of the National Eating Disorders Association and on multiple lived experience advisory groups, supporting research studies, grant initiatives, and patient-centered advocacy efforts. Welcome to the Authors on Fire podcast, Paige.
Ah, Patricia, thank you for that intro. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I am happy to have you. This is a very important topic and very, very timely, I think. There's so many things we need to know of. Let's just dig right in. The book, Searching for Full, is an incredibly personal memoir. But what inspired you to share your story? And what do you hope that readers glean from it?
Thank you. Well, when I first stumbled upon recovery, which was about 4 years ago, I had a lot of extra time on my plate. And I just started writing. For me, writing has always been the best way for me to understand what I'm thinking and process. And so originally I wasn't trying to write a memoir, but 300 pages later, I was like, huh, I actually think I might have something here. And just after talking to people in the eating disorder community and understanding just how underfunded the space is compared to other diseases, and just how far behind we are in understanding the causes and the biological basis of eating disorders, I was hopeful that sharing my story would be a touch point for people to really understand and see why this matters and why we deserve more attention to eating disorders. 100% of the royalties of my book are going back to research. So it really is just advocacy lever to try to get more awareness.
Thank you for doing that. Every little thing helps. You never know who you're going to touch, and often you're never going to hear from people. And sometimes you think you're working in a vacuum, and yet you have no idea of who will be inspired by your words and whose lives you will change. So it's a beautiful thing what you were doing.
Thank you. Wasn't an easy choice. Someone like me that had a history of an eating disorder for over two decades, there's a lot of chaos that goes along with that. I mean, if you want to read about someone hitting their head up against the wall over and over again, or destroying every room they walk into, it's like, hi, it's me. I'm the problem. So it's kind of embarrassing to like decide to share all those stories. But to your point, I am hoping that someone can relate and that it will help others.
You know, I don't think we're ever given a challenge, a burden, a problem without a reason. So this is your reason. You have no idea who you're going to be helping. So thank you. Thank you. I think it's extremely important. You've lived with bulimia for more than 22 years. Looking back, what do you think people most misunderstood about eating disorders and the people living with them?
There's a couple, I would say, big misunderstandings. One is that you have to have a certain look to have an eating disorder. Mainstream media kind of perpetuates that. The truth is that a very small percentage of people living with an eating disorder are clinically underweight. And so it can be very much an invisible disease that we're just, you don't notice. It can go silent. That was certainly the case for me. I was never underweight. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that people think that it's completely psychological and then it's behavioral based. And so, you know, therefore maybe that it can be more in someone's control to make a different choice, willpower, or that's frivolous, you know, oh, I just ate too much. I need to go take care of that in the bathroom by vomiting or something. It's not a real serious disease. And so I think that contributes to why we're underfunded is because people don't take it as seriously, which is a mistake because eating disorders are the second highest mortality rate out of any mental health disorders that we have, second only to the opioid crisis. Before we had the opioid crisis, eating disorders were the number one killer for mental health. So it's a mistake to think that they're frivolous.
Oh my, I did not know that statistic.
Yeah, it's really sad. There's a high rate of suicide for eating disorders, and then just all the health repercussions that you have. If you have bulimia, there's a host of side effects. One of the biggest one is electrolyte imbalance. So you can literally have a heart attack. And people with anorexia, their body just shuts down. Yeah.
In tackling this, Paige, what are the root causes of, like, why would somebody experience this versus the person next to them doesn't? Like, what is that?
It's such a good question. I can't give you one answer. So eating disorders are really, it's almost like a spectrum. Mm-hmm. So what is the root cause for one person might be different from another, which is what makes treatment, one of the reasons treatment is so difficult. But if I had to sort of group it together, what I would say the current understanding is that there are environmental factors that come into play. There are genetics that come into play. And then if you have a genetic if you're predisposed genetically, and then you're in an environment that triggers that genetic expression, then good luck. Society certainly plays a factor with weight stigma and weight bias that we have, like, this mm-hmm. just throughout society. But it's a combination of a bunch of things. But I think the idea that biology plays a role is way under emphasized. Even though most researchers and clinicians acknowledge that it's there, most of the treatments that we have for eating disorders are still pretty much behavioral-based interventions. And, you know, I think that's probably why our relapse rates are so high. You know, depending on what study you read and what disorder you have, I mean, relapse rates after treatment range anywhere between 40 to 60%. Oh. So it's almost, yeah. So it's almost like treatment resistance is the norm. And that really, to me, is stemming from the lack of resources into understanding really what is cooking underneath the hood for these disorders.
Mm-mm-mm. This is all news to me. This is mm-hmm. very fascinating and sad. Sad yeah. that it's news to me. You know that? You know, like a person who's aware of so many things, not to know this almost points exactly to the problem. People don't
right.
know about it.
Yeah. Eating disorders are a hard nut to crack. To get people to know. And I'm just doing my little part. I'm trying as best as I can to bring awareness to people, but I'm glad I taught you something new. Hopefully some of your readers or listeners will hear something new as well.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's what this is all about. So give us a peek into the book.
Sure. So it's a personal memoir. So it starts in my childhood and then takes you through my adolescence and my early adulthood up until current day when I was around 40. And then sort of the miracle is when I found something that helped me, which in my case was a medication that was an off-label medication that no one really was using for eating disorders at the time. And it was really drastic. It was night and day for me. I put my eating disorder in remission in a matter of weeks. And readers will follow along that journey with me and how I pushed myself into the research and advocacy world, whether people liked it or not. And I said, hey, look at me. I'm just one antidote, but we need to study this. Like, I know my mom said I'm a special snowflake, but I can't be the only one in the entire world that this could potentially work for. We need to study this in a scientific manner. And so people will follow along that journey with me.
GLP-1?
Yes. Yes. So I take a low dose GLP medication, which is at first glance probably sounds crazy. But I take such a low dose. I take much lower than what you would take for weight loss. And in my case, it just gave me a little bit of a edge that I needed to make better choices for myself. It turned that dial down in terms of impulse control and regulation and food noise to where I was actually able to make better decisions and eat 3 meals a day, 2 snacks a day. I actually gained weight taking the medication because I was finally able to eat properly and that sort of thing. And so, yeah, my curiosity is around GLP medications and whether or not there's a place for them in very specific cases in the eating disorder community. I think we can say for sure that they're not helpful at all for anyone with a restrictive type eating disorder. So anorexia, for example, they're actually quite dangerous and the opposite of helpful. But my underlying disease was I had binge eating disorder. So I never restricted. I never ate. My problem was that I ate too much. So opposite end of the spectrum in a way.
If this resonates with someone and they can see their situation in this, are healthcare providers up to date on this? So if somebody goes in and says, can we look into this GLP?
That's a really good question.
Yeah.
That's a good question. So this isn't FDA approved for treating eating disorders. We only have 2 FDA approved medications for eating disorders. We have nothing for anorexia. We have 1 for binge eating disorder and 1 for bulimia nervosa. But to answer your question, I think most clinicians are starting to hear about it. A recent meta-analysis just came out that showed that they looked over 25 studies and showed that it is showing to be quite helpful for binge eating disorder, but we don't have any randomized control trials yet. So a clinician is always having to weigh the evidence and also prevent harm. So that's going to be an individual choice to decide if they're going to choose to like prescribe something that's off label or not. But yeah, there are doctors who are actively using it. I would say it's definitely not the first thing that you try. And I don't think it should be the first thing that you try. Mm-hmm. But for those patients that are truly treatment resistant, that are struggling, that may have some different things that point to this potentially being helpful. For example, I have a rare variant on my GLP pathway that we think is linked with binge eating. So for those type of patients, that it might make sense. But people are starting to learn about it. I would like to say it has a lot to do with me because I'm screaming about this on LinkedIn every day. And I've heard from people in the community. They're like, okay, we're watching you. We're listening to you. And I think that's very hopeful. When I first came into this community, I thought everyone was going to shun me, and for the most part, they haven't. They want to listen to me. They want to collaborate with me. They're like, oh well, yeah, this should be studied, because I'm really not advocating for people using this off label right now. We don't have good data. I have no idea like who could help versus harm, and until you really know that, it's a gamble to give it to somebody.
Interesting. It's just another tool that has possibility, something that can be looked at by a clinician who knows what they're looking at too. That I think that's key as well.
Yeah. Wraparound care. Definitely don't try this at home by yourself.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
If you're thinking about it, talk to your doctors about it or reach out to me. I have a long network of people that are up to speed on the literature that would be willing to listen to you and help you decide together if it's a potentially good fit or not.
Excellent. You are a resource, my friend. Thank you. So one of the recurring themes in your book is shame. How did shame influence your journey, and what did it take to finally begin letting go of the self-blame that you followed for so long?
Well, every time I went to treatment, I didn't get better. And so instead of questioning maybe that we were missing something or we didn't have a full understanding of the disease, I actually pointed the finger at my nose and I said, you're the problem, you're the problem, you're the problem, you're the problem. And what that did is it created this gigantic shame cycle that it's almost like every time I went into therapy, I walked out of there actually just feeling worse, and I became more sick because it just made me feel worse and worse and worse that I wasn't getting well. So that stayed with me for the majority of my life. And I thought I was a bad person. I thought that I needed to protect myself from other people because certainly people would try to help me and then I would just drown them with me. And so the best thing I could do in life would be sort of to sequester myself off and focus on my strengths and try not to be a parasite to society, basically. And so when I found the miracle of taking a molecule that completely changed my physiology, I finally had a comparison point and said, wait a minute, like, is this what a quiet brain is supposed to feel like? No wonder I was failing and kept falling on my face. Like, you can do all the therapy you want in the world, but if there's something wrong, and your wiring, like, good luck to you, you know? And so that, so shame replaced with curiosity, and curiosity has a lot more room for action, Because when you're filled with shame, there's not much action there. You can't, like, what's the next step, right? But when you're curious, you can ask more questions and say, like, what was really going on there? Like, what don't we understand? And that's really what I've been focusing my time on. And it's moved me completely away from a judgment-based space and given a lot more compassion and an understanding for myself. Oh. I wish it had come sooner, but here we are.
Yes, yes. Curiosity, that's interesting because that probably speaks to the fact that your story doesn't end with recovery. It evolves into advocacy just because of curiosity. How perhaps did your personal experience inspire you to become involved in eating disorder research and patient advocacy and healthcare reform? Because you didn't have to do that. You could have just solved your problem and moved on.
It felt like I didn't have a choice, but in a good way. I was suffering so intensely, and this medication helped me so much. It, going back to kind of what you said earlier about this is my purpose, and you know, people go through things for a reason. It seemed like, oh, okay, I went through this, all of this, and this is my purpose. My purpose is to try to help the space, and so I just was seeing that I was being received by prominent figures in the eating disorder community and with curiosity and interest that I was like, wow, someone with lived experience can actually add something here, which was its own sort of amazing revelation. You know, I always kind of put doctors and researchers like five tiers above me. And I was like, oh, wow, like I'm actually helping them. Like that feels really good to me. And so that's why I decided to do it. It was making me feel better. It's not an easy path, though. I mean, I have a stigmatized disease and I use a stigmatized treatment, and there's a lot of misunderstanding with the general public. I wouldn't recommend it with people with lived experience. You have to, it takes a certain personality. It's difficult.
Oh, absolutely. I can't even imagine. It's very, very brave to step out and on so many levels here and expose yourself, really.
We'll see. I had one review so far on NetGalley and it was 4 out of 5 stars. So I was like, okay, we're looking good.
Yay. I love the idea about approaching healing with curiosity instead of judgment, not just for this, but for everything. You know, we're most people are going through some kind of something. And that approach with curiosity, I think, could help save a person. So I wonder, that shift in mindset, it changed your relationship with yourself. And is there any reason why you think that this could be a lesson that applies beyond eating disorders?
Oh, absolutely, with everything. I think being curious and open-minded and try to step away from judgment or shame, like, changes. It's a completely different shift in your mentality and the way that you view the world. I'm living a bonus life because of it. I wish I would have figured it out sooner. You know, even if I were still sick, I wish I could have somehow found curiosity for myself. Yeah.
I think one of the key things is that you're doing is to try to amplify patient voices in research, because without the patient voice, the problem goes unheard and therefore unsolved. Why do you believe that lived experience is so important in shaping the future of healthcare and mental health treatment?
Yeah. So lived experience should inform the research questions.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yes.
they should be asking people with living with the diseases what answers we want answered. So there's that. And sometimes they don't know what they don't know. And so they really need to collaborate with people with lived experience. And I think this is with all healthcare now. Lived experience is sort of trending. You know, in Europe, for example, you can't even get a grant unless you have someone with lived experience on the grant. It's not like that here in the United States yet, but people are listening and they want people with lived experience. And it wasn't like that 10 years ago. People with lived experience, no one listened. They weren't really that part of the community. And now they definitely are. So that's good. That's hopeful.
It is. It's extremely valuable. I went into patient advocacy around 2009 after my mom had a horrible hospital healthcare experience, that it just forced me to either go crazy with it or write, just as you did.
Right.
So I wrote a book and became a patient advocate and and started a radio show. It was the first to talk about patient safety and healthcare and hospital hazards. And everyone said, oh, you know, hospitals are going to shun this. They don't want to hear about it. And it really turned out to be quite the opposite, where the patient experience became departments within huge hospitals. So like the Cleveland Clinic and the Mayo would invite me to come and speak from a lived experience, from a family member's viewpoint, was something that they never had before. You've got the people up at the top making decisions that have nothing to do with lived experience.
That's
so it's, again, it's a scary thing to go out and do, because you know you're going to get in trouble with some people, but it almost becomes something that you have to do. So for me, the voice of a lived experience kind of trumps everything else.
I feel like some clinicians might have been a little bit offended. You know, I heard someone once said that I came across too angry or something. But I always step back and I go, okay, who am I really? What's my purpose? And my purpose is the two or three women that reach out to me every week that say, me too, that say they're too afraid to talk to anyone about this. They don't feel like anyone's going to listen to them. They can't even tell their partners that they're taking these medications. Like, that's who I'm fighting for. And I care what they think of me, you know, like, I don't care if they, I mean, I kind of care, but that's really my test. Am I doing them right? And that's what keeps me going.
Exactly. You mentioned women. Is this, are eating disorders common in men?
Yeah, it is. So it's more common in women, but up to a third, I think the stats about up to a third of people with eating disorders are men. But I would say the idea that historically it has been a female disease is part of the reason why we don't have any funding.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I don't recall ever hearing about a man with an eating disorder.
Yes. I think it probably goes more undiagnosed than we would like. But yes, again, it's up to a third. You know, there's that orthorexia, which is sort of the, I'm not going to do a good job defining it, but, you know, working out a lot, being super obsessed with what you eat, eating clean, that sort of thing. That's a really common one with men.
Yes, yes, yes. So that makes sense. What qualifies then as an eating disorder?
Oh, I'm not a clinician and I don't have the DMS definitions memorized.
Yeah.
But there's quite a few of them. The popular ones that probably everyone that's listening now has heard of are anorexia and bulimia. The most common eating disorder is actually binge eating disorder. It's 80% of eating disorders are binge eating disorder. And that's where you eat a high amount quantities of food at a time, so a certain amount of times per week. And then you have a lot of mental distress afterwards. And then there's a whole bunch of other ones, but yeah, there's a bunch of different clinical definitions of them. That's one of, it's a like side topic, but you know, most of our mental health disorders are defined by symptoms. And that in itself is a little bit problematic if you're trying to understand the biology of them. You know, it's an interesting thing, the DSM.
Oh, that's interesting. Yes. The symptoms. And they probably would be so wide and varied, or maybe even unidentifiable, that a person might not even know. I mean,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Psychiatrists, they have to rely on what their patients are telling them. You know, a cardiologist can look at the heart, a cancer, yes. An oncologist can look at a PET scan, but psychiatrists and psychologists are purely relying on the words of their patients in order to diagnose. And, you know, so that's something.
This is complicated.
It's complicated. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The title. I love the title. Searching for Full. How did that come about?
That was a process. It wasn't my first choice. I thought I had something that was really clever and everyone else told me that it was definitely not clever.
Don't you love that?
I love it. So Searching for Full, you could take that actually for what it is, which is that I always felt hungry. But for readers that read my book, you'll see a common theme of where I just felt empty throughout my entire life, both with like my love relationships, feeling like I needed to get validation from other people. I would lie about my accomplishments because I felt that I wasn't enough with who I was. And so Searching for Full is a nod to that as well.
We get that. So when does the book release?
Thank you. It comes out January 12th.
Okay. So for pre-order now or not yet?
Yes, it's
Okay.
available anywhere that you could buy books for pre-order. I would love a pre-order. You're doing a good thing. Goes to research. It helps with the sales.
Absolutely. All right, in January. So, as we begin to wrap up, anything we missed that you wanted to highlight today?
Yes, for anyone listening today that is thinking like, oh, I wonder if there's some things that I might have struggles with. I wonder if I have an eating disorder. If you go to NEDAW's website, which is the nationaleatingdisorders.org, they have a wonderful screener there that you can fill out. It's confidential. And depending on your answers, they will point you to next steps to talk to a medical professional. So I always like to tell people about that if they don't know where to start.
Okay, nationaleatingdisorders.org. That very, very important. And I think that yeah, to be able to fill out that form and get at least a start to try to
That's
figure
right.
out where to move. All righty. Well, if you would then share contact information where folks can find out more about you and get pre-order copies of this book.
Great. So my website is pagegordonauthor.com. And on there, you'll have links that you can go to for pre-order. But, if you just look anywhere, you can get it. I'm very active on Instagram, which my handle there is also Paige Gordon Author, and I'm quite active on LinkedIn as well under Paige Gordon. So I'd love to hear from anyone. I have a contact form. I will write you back, especially if you have lived experience. I give everyone my time. It's very common for people to want to have Zoom meetings with me, and so far I've been able to keep up with that. So please reach out to me if you want someone to talk to.
Oh, excellent. Thank you for that. This is beautiful. What a resource. Paige Gordon, that's PAIGE. Paige
Yes.
Gordon, GORDON, author.com. I'm going to follow you on Instagram and LinkedIn if I haven't already. And
Great.
thank you. Thank you for being brave and for stepping out and for helping others. That is a gift that just goes beyond, anything that I can even imagine. So you're a beautiful soul to do this. Thank you.
Thank you, Patricia. It's fun talking to you today.